She could see nothing. She knew she was in the dark pit. And indeed, even the light of the moon had disappeared when she had gone over the edge. But she could not feel the walls about her. Just the wind, growing as she plummeted ever faster, whipping her shift about her, bending her face out of shape, threatening to rip the two crystals from her hand, so much so that she clutched them tightly to her chest and slapped her other hand above them. And she felt, too, the cold, deepening, reaching into her bones, stealing her life. She felt herself tumbling over backward, head down. Auron tried to cry out, expecting to shatter her skull at any moment. Not that it would have mattered, she realized, and perhaps would be better if she landed that way, to end it quickly. She reached her thoughts out, seeking some diamond-flecked crystals so that she could at least see. She sent her thoughts out all about, seeking the song of Uskar, seeking crystals on the walls, if there even were walls. But she found nothing out there, and it wasn't until Auron retrieved her sensibilities that she felt the first tug of Uskar from one of the crystals she held. She reached into it with all her strength, and heard the song deep within, far away, tiny. But she felt those green flakes, and sang back to them. She felt their vibrations, and she sent her own from her heart, from her line of life. She sang louder and forgot she was falling. So deeply did she fall into the glow and magic of Uskar. No longer did the notes seem tiny and far away. She could picture them now, in her mind, coming closer, answering her call. Together they sang, Auron and the Magic Crystal. It took her many heartbeats to even realize that her fall had slowed, that the wind was but a breeze now, and she opened her eyes, but saw nothing, for the blackness seemed deeper still. She hung there for just a moment, disoriented. Was she upside down? Were her feet below her and near to a floor? How far had she fallen? She thought she had made an error then, for she began to move again, and panicked as she feared it a fatal mistake as she once again began to gain speed. Auron threw her thoughts fully into the crystal, screamed for it to help her, to stop her descent. But no, she was speeding once more. Shona stirred and opened her eyes to greet the sunrise. A sunrise that had come earlier because they were on the back side of the mountain. After a moment of reorienting herself to her surroundings and trying to recall all about the previous evening, she was surprised to learn that she was no longer lying right before the entrance to the crystal cavern, but was, rather, back by the campfire. Conabra winked at her, clearly recognizing her confusion, and Shona nodded and understood. Conabra and the others had carried her here. As anxious as she remained about Auron's fate, Shona couldn't be mad at that choice. For how much more might her bones ache had she spent the night on the cold ground? She pulled herself up to a seated position and regarded the sunrise. Her head immediately swiveled back down to the cave entrance, where a pair of witches maintained the illusionary wall.
Auron has not emerged, she asked.
Conabra shook her head.
She is back near the entrance, though,
Shona prompted. You have heard her stirring. We will find her when we open the cave.
No, said a somber Conabra, shaking her head. We've had no sight or sound of the girl since she began wandering the caverns.
The sun is above the horizon,
Shona protested.
Why is the cave not opened?
Soon.
It is past time.
Shona climbed to her feet.
Shona,
Conabra said, leaping up and taking her by the arm, and looking to the side, thus drawing Shona's gaze to the men, particularly Te Orlig and Raybert, who were all looking back at her sternly.
Shona,
Conabra repeated more quietly, it is not your choice to make. She motioned down to the side.
where another pair of witches were looking up at her. Both had bowls of steaming stew before them, tubers and roots, and one had another in hand and was filling it, or Shona, obviously.
The Uskarigin will tell us when,
Konabra added. With a sigh and a glance to the cave entrance, Shona sat back down and accepted the bowl from the other woman. She ate slowly, not really hungry, her stomach churning as she worried over the fate of her student, her niece, her protégé.
When last did anyone peer into the cavern? She asked. When the moon touched the western horizon.
As is permitted, Conabra reminded.
That was many hours ago. Take heart, for we're sure to find Aulan sitting where we left her.
Shona returned the woman's comforting smile. She wished she could share that optimism too. She glanced at the rising sun 100 times over the next short while. It seemed to move not at all. Time itself had stopped, it seemed. She wanted to scream out, to run down and take up a crystal and call forth its power to look inside the cave, to find Aulan. A feeling that Aulan needed her, that they would find the girl lying broken on the floor, overwhelmed her. Had Aulan's mind been shattered by the magic?
Shona thought of her sister, reduced to babbling incoherence after her encounter with the power of the Fossa.
Had the magic of the cavern done the same to Aulan? Or was Aulan already dead?
She had to know.
She dropped her bowl and stood up to pace about, tapping her finger nervously to her bottom lip. She glanced up the rise and noted Te Orlig staring back at her, and smiling his awful smile. The truth of his thoughts seemed clear to her. Ever was that one taking pleasure in her discomfort. She tried to compose herself, unsuccessfully. She nearly jumped out of her shoes when Mehren at last shouted that it was time to open the cavern. The first rays of dawn seeped about Aulan's eyelids and roused her. Groggily, she pulled herself up to her elbows, blinked the sleep out of her eyes, and looked all about. She was on the ground, right beside Kresa Dia. For a moment, that confused her, but then she smiled, remembering her fall, remembering her magical halt to the fall, and then her second fall. Except, she had come to understand when she saw again the moonlight, that the second plummet was really her soaring upward. She had brought forth the power of the green-flecked crystal to reverse her fall, and it had carried her right up through the ceiling of the cavern, this very chasm the Uskar called the Mouth of God. Aulan closed her eyes and basked in the warm memories of the overwhelming magical song that had flowed so fully through her, and in the realization that she had passed her test, certainly, that she had escaped. A smile of self-satisfaction disappeared almost immediately, though, and she hopped up to her knees and began reaching all about her with her hands, searching for the two crystals. There they were, right beside her, and she scooped them up and brought them lovingly to her breast, particularly the green-flecked one that had saved her life. Aulan crept over and glanced into the maw of the chasm, and saw far below the deeper blackness of the pit. She didn't know how far she had fallen that previous night, or how much farther she had to fall before she found its bottom. But it was a long, long way. It occurred to her that it was possibly deeper than Furok Spoer was tall. One day she would know, she vowed. One day she would take this crystal, or one like it, along with a diamond-flecked crystal for magical light, and explore that pit. The thought brought a chill, though, and the memory of the shadowy creature confronting her, a creature she thought was the spectre of her own death. There were secrets in the dark depths of that pit, Aulan knew. The one thing Aulan liked about secrets was uncovering them. They all approached the cave entrance together, women and men, and no one spoke a word. The Uskar Regin gave a nod to the women maintaining the enchantment, and she released her magical energies, allowing the illusion to fade and the cave's entrance to be revealed. And within, the long corridor and an empty chamber. No one was supposed to say a word until the Uskar Regin gave permission, but Shona couldn't suppress a small wail.
"Well, let us return to our people," Naren said with a heavy sigh, and she offered a quick prayer of, "Uskar, take her kindly."
Shona, though, moved for the cave.
"No,"
Conabra and several others admonished her. Shona caught herself mid-step and glanced sheepishly at the Uskar Regin, finding Naren's cold stare waiting for her. She apologized, and the group began filtering away.
"Perhaps you will find the girl when you enter the cave from a different entrance," Thay Orlig whispered to Shona as he walked by her.
Shona wanted to lash out back at him, but she didn't, caught by surprise at the man's tone, for truly he seemed disappointed, angry even, that Aulan was not here awaiting them. Too many emotions and fears grabbed at her then, and so she just began walking off behind the others.
"Where are you all going?"
The voice, the girl's shout, came from high above. As one, the group gasped and looked upward, to Aulan, sitting on a ledge up on the cliff face, her feet dangling, swinging back and forth carelessly. She met Shona's eyes directly, and the two exchanged heartfelt smiles. The group gasped again, all but Shona, when Aulan kicked off from the ledge. Aulan floated gently to the ground, landing gracefully among them.
"Breath will have to wait,"
Shona said bitingly to Tay Orlig. The man just grinned an unsettling, conniving smirk, and Shona got the distinct impression that he was hardly upset by that notion. 22. Magical Jacks. Over the next few weeks, Aulan used every spare moment to experiment with the two crystals she had taken from the caverns. Shona and the other witches had let her keep them, and even more amazing to the young woman, she wasn't being discouraged in her experimentation with the magic. It also seemed to her that she was being given more free time. The song of Uskar contained within the crystal seemed fainter than it had been in the cave, though, more distant. She didn't need a teacher to explain that the vibrations of magic within the crystal-filled labyrinth had somehow made the song louder and more accessible to her. Never had Aulan felt more attuned to the magic than in her time wandering the caverns beneath Kreas Adird, not even when she was in the tree beside the great angled crystal manifestation of the god itself. She wanted to go back to the cave. She had even asked Shona if it would be possible. The answer made it clear that there would be no such possibility, and offered no compromise. Aulan was not a stranger to mischief, but Shona had made it clear that any excursion she might take secretly to the caverns would ruin her entirely. Aulan's teacher had even hinted that if she snuck away for such a journey, she'd be caught, and then would indeed go into the cave, thrown into Kreas Adird itself, and never to come back out. Aulan dearly wanted to get back to the caves, and knew that Shona had seen the near desperation on her face. Every time she tried to use her green-flecked crystal, she wanted to get back there all the more, for the song was distant out here. Aulan had trouble aligning her inner energy with the hum of the magic, more so than she had experienced while alone in the labyrinth. There was simply too much noise. The day-to-day life of the Uskar drowned out the crystal song. She could still manage to levitate, but barely, and there was no way she would risk the type of controlled descent she had used to rejoin Shona and the others outside the cavern. She could still lift other objects off the ground, but only the tiniest of stones,
and nothing like she had performed with Shona's crystal that day in the tent. Aulan didn't understand it, and it bothered her. Was it her? Had she somehow damaged her magical abilities? Or was it the crystal? She purposely awakened early one morning to try to find out. It was still dark, and she heard Shona's rhythmic breathing. Delicately, Aulan rolled off her cot and onto her knees on the floor, and slowly, so slowly, she crept across the room. Aulan couldn't really see it in the darkness, but it committed this room to memory. She made for Shona's robe, which was hung on a hook at the foot of her bed, fighting hard to contain her excitement, repeatedly reminding herself to go slow. She shuffled a bit too much, and Shona stirred. Aulan held perfectly still for many heartbeats, before beginning again. Her relief at reaching the robe was short-lived. The pockets were empty. Her eyes had adjusted to the darkness a bit by then, and she made out Shona's form in the cot. Shona's shift had a pocket. Aulan got to the side of the cot, and there she froze, settling in, letting Shona get used to the presence and settle more deeply into sleep. Slowly, Aulan moved her hand, low, near the woman's belly, but not touching. She knew where the pocket was located, and was fairly certain that her hand was positioned right over it. But there she held in place again, gathering her courage, steadying her hand. She reached for the pocket. She felt the crystals. She felt Shona's hand clamp hard over her wrist. The older woman sat up forcefully, throwing Aulan's hand aside, and Aulan fell back from the cot. A light came up, just a little one, glowing from Shona's pocket.
"What are you about, girl?"
the woman demanded, and her eyes, lit from below by the diamond-flecked crystal in Shona's shift, looked demonic.
"You would do well to tell me at once,"
Shona pressed.
I just wanted to borrow—
"Borrow?"
the woman growled angrily.
"How dare!"
She started to come forward as if to attack Aulan, but she stopped herself and stared at the young woman curiously.
"Why?"
Shona asked, her voice calm once more.
"I just wanted one, and only for a moment."
"And you could not ask?"
"I could not wait,"
Aulan exclaimed. Shona stared at her for a long while.
"Why?"
"Just the green-flecked one, like the one you let me keep."
Shona nodded, reminding her that she had not answered the question. Aulan swallowed hard, not sure how to actually explain her fears or questions.
"Go on. We've come too far now for you to be lying to me."
Aulan pulled out her own crystal.
"I can't do much at all with this crystal," she said.
"You jumped from a cliff and floated down."
"Here, I mean,"
Aulan explained.
"I felt so mighty with it that night in the cave and the next morning. But here, it is almost useless in my hands."
She sniffled, and was surprised that she was so near to tears.
"I think I have lost the magic."
Shona shook her head and put on a comforting smile.
"No, girl, you have not lost your magic. The crystals function more powerfully near Kreas Adiad. It is almost as if the crystals within the cave reach out to them and add to their strength, and to the powers of the witch."
"But I'm not as strong as I was, even here,"
she cried.
"Go fetch the crystal that lets you float down to us,"
Shona bade her. Aulan retrieved it, and was surprised to see Shona holding a crystal of her own when she returned to the cot.
"Reach inside your crystal," said Shona. "Attune yourself to its song. Hear Uskar in your heart, and be as one with the music within the crystal."
Aulan did as she was told. She felt the magic whispering within the crystal, and within herself, but it seemed distant once more, barely accessible. After a few frustrating moments,
She opened her eyes.
What shall I do with it?
Shona motioned with her hand. Give it to me. Aulan handed it over, somewhat reluctantly, for she feared that she would not get it back. She was surprised when Shona took it and held out her own crystal in exchange.
Do it again, with mine, she explained.
Aulan brought the crystal in against her breath and searched for the song, and found it, waiting for her, thrumming powerfully, her eyes opened in shock.
Did I break the other one?
No, silly girl, Shona said with a laugh.
But...
Aulan shook her head, seeming at a loss. She looked down at the crystal she now held, and felt certain that she could leap from the highest peak of Firoxpoer and use it to float down gently. She was smiling, despite herself, when she looked back at Shona, her expression curious, expecting an answer. But Shona held silent, and wore her teacher's face sternly. Aulan lost her smile, and focused again on the gem, her thoughts spinning. She glanced at the crystal Shona now held, then to this one, before looking up again, nearly gasping as she did.
They're not all the same,
Aulan blurted.
What do you mean?
The crystals, even the ones with the same colors in them, she said,
talking so fast that her thoughts could hardly keep up.
They are different in...
She stuttered about, looking for the word.
Power,
Shona offered, and Aulan wagged her head excitedly.
The one you hold now is quite powerful, quite loud with the song of Uskar, Shona explained. This one you had given me can only whisper.
Unless I am near the crystal cave, Kresa Diad, Aulan said triumphantly.
She felt quite pleased, and more so because Shona looked quite pleased.
Go to bed, young Aulan, she said. I will forgive you for waking me, just this once.
Aulan wagged her head happily and spun about.
Aulan, Shona barked,
and Aulan swung about to see Shona motioning with one hand and holding Aulan's weaker crystal with the other. The girl sheepishly completed the exchange. Her fears had been calmed, but Aulan got no further sleep that night. Her thoughts chased many tangents in an attempt to sort out these beauteous revelations. The Uskar encampment bristled with excitement as the last raid of the season drew near. While the warriors were down by the lake hunting for supplies and slaves, the camp would move to the winter plateau. The thought made Aulan giddy. She believed that she would find much greater magical powers nearer to Kresa Diad, and Shona had hinted that she would be given new crystals to study during the short days of winter. She would not participate in the ritual that preceded the raid this season, but in that too, Shona had teased her, hinting quietly that Aulan would possibly be included in the dance and the blessing of the weapons. The thought both intrigued and terrified the young woman, reminding her keenly that she was a woman now, and that her days were relatively carefree compared to the responsibilities that might soon be upon her. Suppose she blessed the weapon incorrectly. Her blunder would cost a warrior his very life. During those last days of the summer encampment, Aulan found herself with little to do. Aside from the basic cleaning and food gathering, Shona set out no other tasks, and even encouraged Aulan to go and experiment with her crystal, or to wander as her heart led her. So she did, meandering about, using her green-flecked crystal to scare away a squirrel by lifting the acorn it sought into the air, then catching the squirrel itself with the magic as it leaped high for a tree. The creature floated up to the branches, and as soon as she was certain it had caught onto one, a giggling Aulan released the magic. She spent many hours seeing just how high she could leap with the help of the stone. She ran, she jumped, using the magic to elevate her higher and farther by turn. For all the silly ways Aulan found to amuse herself, though, the days remained quite long,
at least until she found another who was as unengaged as she, the slave boy, Adlan.
"Nothing to do?" she asked, coming up behind him as he sat.
Adlan turned and smiled at her, but motioned for her to be quiet, then turned his attention back to watch a tortoise that was trying, unsuccessfully, to clamber over a stone. At first, Alan was more intrigued by the boy than the tortoise. He had been working hard in the last couple of years, a beast of burden for the tribe. His days were spent hauling buckets of water, carrying deer and other animals killed in the hunts, or simply moving stones. He never complained. All of it was having a profound effect on the young man's body. He was thin. They didn't feed him very much. But his sinewy muscles were hard and tight. His filthy shirt was torn, revealing his upper back, and that, too, rippled with lean muscle. Aulan admired his form, nodding at his strength, and found herself wondering if, in a couple of years hence, there would be an Uma's man in the tribe. She blinked and noted Badlan's intensity as he watched that poor tortoise trying to climb over the rock. Aulan grinned and clutched her crystal to her breast. The tortoise began easily walking up the side of the stone, climbed right over it, and gently floated back to the ground on the other side, to continue on its way. Badlan nearly jumped to his feet, and when he looked back to Aulan, the astonishment painted on his face made her giggle.
"I did it," she said,
to which the boy responded with a confused look. Aulan showed him the green-flecked crystal from which he immediately recoiled.
"Oh, don't be afraid," she said. "It's mine. I control it. It won't hurt you." She had an idea. "Do you want to play a game?"
The boy hesitated for a long while, then only tentatively nodded.
"I didn't have to ask, you know," Aulan reminded. "I could have told you that we were going to play a game and you would have to, wouldn't you?"
When he didn't respond, she told him to stand up. Aulan reached inside the crystal with all her power, focusing on him.
"Jump!" she commanded suddenly, and she threw her telekinetic power at him.
Badlan did jump, reflexively, but even with Aulan's magic, the young man didn't get very high, nothing out of the ordinary. Aulan snorted. How she wished she had shown us crystal instead. She imagined Badlan flying up into the air, his feet higher than a tall man's head. He'd cry out, surely, and she could float him back down to the ground. The thought had her giggling once more.
And she found another idea. "Follow me," she instructed,
and she went back towards the Uskar encampment, just a few dozen paces from the camp's southern edge, down in a rocky dell, and out of sight of the encampment.
"Watch," she told Badlan.
She sat cross-legged on the ground and spotted a nearby pebble. With the crystal, she magically floated it off the ground. Badlan gave a stifled little cry of surprise and fear.
"Oh, don't be afraid," Aulan scolded.
The pebble rose to the sitting girl's eye level, and she brought a second one up as well, to the other side of her, but both very near. Aulan took a deep breath, then let the magic drop, and so let the stones drop. Fast as a striking snake, her free hand shot out and caught the stones. One, two. She opened her hand before Badlan, revealing her victory.
"I've caught as many as six," she bragged. "How many do you think you can catch?"
He seemed not to understand.
"Sit," she told him. And when he did, she asked, "Which hand will you use?"
He still seemed not to understand.
"To catch the pebbles,"
the girl explained, and in her exasperation she almost called him Thump.
"Which hand? You can only use one."
Badlan looked at his hands, shrugged, and held up the left. Aulan nodded and chewed her lower lip, clutching the crystal tight once more.
"Wait for me to tell you when to catch them," she said.
On the ground before Badlan, a pebble shook and lifted.
then a second, and a third joined it, the three floating up to the sitting boy's eye level.
Ready?
Badlan nodded.
Go!
Alan said, and released the magic. The stones fell, and Badlan caught them. One, two, and almost three, the last pebble bouncing off the side of his hand and flying aside.
Oh, nearly!
Alan exclaimed. Put them down and do it again. He caught all three the next try. And so they made a competition of it, and were soon laughing. Then they worked together. How many could they catch using all four hands, Alan wondered. She tucked the crystal under her chin and, to her delight, discovered that she could hear the song in that position, even without her fingers about the item. As she did that, Badlan fetched a bunch of pebbles, laying them all about the ground before them. Instead of focusing her magic on one at a time, Alan concentrated on the area itself. And sure enough, more than a score of pebbles floated into the air. Alan found it hard to breathe from the excitement, amazed by her control of the magic. This was the best kind of practice, she decided then and there. She was finding out so much more about what she might do, and it was fun.
Ready?
She asked. Badlan nodded eagerly and rubbed his fingers together.
Go!
Pebbles flew every which way, and in the end, Aulan opened her hand and said, Five, dropping the pebbles to the ground. Badlan put his down beside hers, and Aulan started counting them. She had barely begun when the boy said, 12. Aulan finished her count, and nodded her agreement before her eyes went wide, and she gawked at Badlan. He had produced the number before she had finished counting.
He hadn't counted, she realized. He had added. He knew that he had 7, and she had mentioned her 5. And this boy, this simpleton, whose own mother proclaimed as stupid, had added them together in the snap of fingers.
Aulan stared at him for a long while, and Badlan looked away.
We should do it again, she said. Do you think we can get more?
The boy looked back and nodded, his smile returning.
I have 9,
Aulan announced after the next round, though she didn't put them down. She looked at Badlan slyly.
How many did you catch?
Badlan opened his hands, revealing 7 once more.
7,
Aulan said.
How many did we catch?
The boy licked his lips.
More than last time, she asked.
He nodded.
You know how many,
she said suspiciously. Obviously so. He swallowed hard.
Say the number.
He started to shake his head slowly, but Aulan sharply demanded,
The number!
60... The boy stopped short and glanced all around as if looking at a way to run away. Aulan was beginning to understand. She didn't openly accuse him then, however, and decided to keep going to see if she could get him to lower his guard.
16,
she proclaimed happily, smile beaming.
We caught more than the first time,
putting a bit more excitement than was necessary into her words, hoping to help Badlan to not be nervous.
We'll catch more this time,
Aulan promised.
They didn't. In fact, they came close a couple of times, but 16 remained the highest number as they continued their game, round after round, laughing and playing.
At one point, Aulan lifted 3 different stones and began experimenting with the magic in a different way, letting one drop, then catching it with the telekinesis as she let a second one drop, then catching that as the third fell. As she did that, Badlan took up 3 small stones of his own and began juggling them. And it occurred to Aulan that they were both doing the same thing, she with the magic of Uskar, he with nimble hands. They soon went back to their other game, but by then daylight was fast waning, and it grew harder to even see the pebbles, let alone catch them. Still, they tried, stubbornly, to beat 16. But now they couldn't get close, and wound up slapping more pebbles than they caught. It didn't matter, though. The silliness seemed to only make the time more precious, the day more fun. But then the moon peeked over the shoulder of Firoxbuer, as if to spy on them. A red moon. The blood moon. The face of Isebal. But Lan gulped.
Aulan turned to him just as he was jumping to his feet, already moving away before he had fully stood up.
Rising, she caught him by the arm, but he tugged against her.
"Run," he said.
"Why?" the young woman asked, staring at him earnestly. She knew why, of course, but what could this simpleton slave possibly understand about Isebal?
"Lisbeth,"
Adlan replied.
"Lisbeth?"
Adlan pointing at the rising orb and enunciating more clearly.
"Elizabeth! The name of the moon? You call it Elizabeth?"
He nodded frantically, and kept pulling her along, clearly desperate to be out of there and back to his mother in the pine grove.
"That's what your people call it,"
Aulan pressed. She knew that she had to let him go. He had farther to run than she did, after all. But there was something else here, some level of insight or understanding that she had not witnessed with the young Baglan before.
"Your mother taught you that?"
He nodded again.
"What else did she teach you about it, besides its name?"
she asked. He shrugged and held up his hands.
"Lots, huh?"
Aulan asked in a teasing and jocular manner.
"And you can keep more still in that funny head of yours?"
He shook his head. Too emphatically, she thought.
"You don't have enough words?"
"No," he said, sounding more cogent and determined than she had ever heard. "No time." Aulan couldn't really argue with that, as surprised as she was by his reaction. This was the first time she had been with Badlan with the blood moon rising, since that long-ago day when they had been out collecting pine cones for Shona. Though, on that occasion, he hadn't shown such fear. She pulled him with her instead of letting him run, taking him to the edge of the Uskar encampment, where the bonfire was already ablaze, and sentries moving out to the camp's perimeter.
"We're safe here," she said, finding an out-of-the-way place. "Tell me."
Batlan glanced all around, focusing mostly on the camp and not on the darkness beyond.
She shook him. "Tell me, and I'll take you back to your mother."
The boy swallowed hard.
"I know you can talk," she warned. "Might that I'll tell the warriors."
His eyes went very wide, and he trembled visibly, and Aulan immediately got the sense that he would spring upon her and throttle her. Only then did she realize how important this particular secret truly might be. For only then did the young woman understand it from the poor boy's point of view, and from his mother's point of view. She, Inava, had done this to him from his earliest days, and only now did Aulan understand why.
"I will never tell them," she said quietly. "I will never tell anyone, Thump, and I will never let them hurt you."
He seemed to calm.
"What do you know about about Elizabeth? Please whisper to me. It is important."
Adlan put his lips to her ear and began whispering something she couldn't decipher, and it took her a lot of words, more words than she had ever heard strung together by the boy, certainly, to figure out that he wasn't speaking the common language of the tribes, but rather something that sounded more primitive and guttural, short and stout, and very different from the flowing language of the mountain tribe.
He spoke in a low monotone, not unlike the chanting the coven used often in their rituals.
"Is that the language of the lake tribes?" she asked. "Some secret way of talking?"
"Older,"
Adlan answered.
"Older?"
"The ancients," he explained. "Old lessons."
"What does it mean?"
Adlan looked all around again, and Aulan realized that he was making sure that no other Uska were around, reinforcing her new insight of how critical it was to him. Indeed, his very life depended upon it, that no one understood how well he could truly speak.
"Elizabeth bleeds, and the beast wakes," the boy said, his voice hushed. "The world bleeds with her."
Aulan didn't know how to respond, for too many things bounced about in her head. Adlan had spoken in two different languages, and he had spoken in a clear and reasonable manner, in complete sentences. In that moment, he seemed in no way to resemble a simpleton who was once called Thump. Also, the lake men clearly understood the danger of the Blood Moon. Had they been visited by the Fossa as well? And who were these ancients, or ancient lessons, or whatever it might be? It was all too much for Aulan at that moment, so when Badlan whispered, "Please, home," she could only nod and lead the way. Aulan ignored the sentry's call for her to stay in the camp, and ran to the south with Badlan in tow, sprinting the short distance to the slave grove. Badlan led the way, moving in with certainty through the tangled branches. Aulan heard the boy's mother gasp with obvious relief when he pressed deeper into the pines. She, too, had seen the Blood Moon. Aulan pushed her way into that inner chamber, to see Badlan's mother hugging him close, her arm wrapped tightly about him, kissing him all over his head. Aulan felt something welling up inside her she did not expect, and could hardly fathom. Envy. Ineva looked past her boy to see Aulan, her face a mask of utter relief. She nodded at the young woman, then motioned for her son to go into his chamber beside hers, two natural shelters separated by some intertwining branches.
"Greetings, Ineva,"
Aulan said at last, meekly. The woman's gaze went to the floor. She answered in a quiet tone,
"Greetings, mistress."
"Not mistress," Aulan said, moving into the room and bending to bring her eyes to Ineva's level.
"Just Aulan."
"I know.
Your son has told you much about me."
The woman looked up, her face twitching with nervousness. She shook her head slowly.
"He cannot speak. But you know of me,"
Aulan stated, more than asked.
"There are not so many Uskar," Ineva answered. "An Umas must know."
Aulan let her stare linger for a little bit, then glanced to the side, to the corridor where the boy had gone. She noted him in the other chamber, moving back and forth.
"My gratitude, mistress, for bringing Thump home."
Aulan snapped her head back to look the woman in the eye.
"His name is Badlan,"
she said through gritted teeth. She wasn't sure why Ineva's use of the demeaning name had so bothered her. Perhaps it was because she was jealous of the obvious relationship between Badlan and Ineva. Aulan had never known her own mother, after all. And from what she knew of her people, even if she had, she would not get hugged and kissed like that anyway. Shona was the closest thing she had, and she'd only ever known a slap across the face from her teacher. Or maybe it was something else, she began to wonder. She thought back to the first time she had looked in on Ineva and her baby, those many years before. She still remembered it, and vividly. The moment had been burned into her mind forever when she had heard Ineva telling her child, her innocent baby, that he was stupid.
"We call him Thump,"
Ineva said, again looking at the floor.
"And I say Badlan,"
Aulan snapped back.
"So which will it be?" "Badlan, mistress,"
Ineva said.
"You are mistress. I am Umas. It is not my place to choose."
Aulan wasn't sure how to move this conversation along. Many things continued to bounce about her thoughts. Most prominently, her understanding now that Badlan was nowhere near as simple and stupid as she had presumed, even when she had come to believe that he wasn't simple enough to hold the name of Thump. What was happening here was much deeper than anything she had before imagined. She was pretty sure she knew the truth, but only Ineva could confirm. But not then. She was about to bid Inva farewell and take her leave, when a cry went up from outside.
"To the fire!" they cried. "To the camp! The she-rascals have come! A raid!"
23. The World Bleeds. Their time on the mountain plateau was nearing its end. The north winds had begun to blow, and Talmadge and Cote had visited four of the villages now, including crossing the lake to Selet Tulloch, the easternmost village, nestled among the mountains that lined the eastern edge of the plateau. In their initial journey to get to Loch Beag, Talmadge and Cote had to approach from the northeast, crossing all the way around the northern edge of the plateau to the easier climb beyond the northwestern edge of Loch Beag. That corner of the mountain plateau presented a long trail, but not a vertical climb. Talmadge had not second-guessed his choice to allow Cote into more of the villages this year, for in every one she had been afforded great hospitality. Talmadge's own acceptance to these lands had come much more slowly than his exotic friend was experiencing. She understood these people more than Talmadge did, even though he had spent many months among them. The Togai Ru ways were similar to the folk of the tribes. The affinity to the land around them, the understanding and efficiency of the language, and the daily routines. Cote had been a natural fit here, around the waters of the loch. As soon as he had become certain of these perceptions regarding Cote, and confident that they would be common about the tribes, Talmadge had changed his normal trading route, had decided to save the best village for last. He wondered if he and Cote might one day make Fussach Cran their home. They were still young enough to have children. Was it possible that his future would take such a turn?
"I've not known more amazement,"
Cote said from behind the man, who was gazing back to the south, toward Fussach Cran. He turned about to regard the woman as she stood at the crest of the path they had walked, facing away from him. He knew what she was talking about. She was overlooking the desert, some 2,000 feet below. Fasail Dovchlak, the desert of black stones. Although he had been to this place many times, Talmadge understood Cote's awe at the spectacle so far beneath them. He remembered the first time he had glanced over this very ledge, and the first thought that had occurred to him regarding the unusual landscape. They were high up on a mountain plateau, beside a huge lake that was, by all reports, very, very deep. Deeper even than the mountains were high. So the tribesman said. That lake lay in a natural bowl. What would happen to that bone-dry desert below them if an earthquake cracked the mountain wall? If the natural dam, holding back such an immense amount of water, someday failed? What a sight that would be. And not a very welcomed one to anyone who might live down there in the desert of black stones. He walked over to stand beside his beloved Cote, and appreciated the view even more. The sun had just set, but the deep night had not yet arrived, and he could still clearly make out the large shapes down below. The stars were just beginning to shine, and soon an amount beyond counting would fill the night sky, their light competing with the full moon. He stepped behind Cote and wrapped his arms about her. Perhaps they might spend the night out here, feeling so much a part of something so much larger. Larger than each of them. Larger than them together. Like the way he felt about his love for her. The night deepened. The stars began to shine. And both Cote and Talmadge drew in a sharp breath, gasping in awe and reverence. Out across the low desert before them, and down to the south, they saw the floating hues low in the sky. It was a rare sight this far north, but Talmadge knew it to be the halo. Cote reached up over her shoulder to run her fingers across Talmadge's face. What was there to say? What words could express the serenity, the beauty of this heavenly view, with the dark desert spreading wide far below, and the magical equatorial ring of Corona shimmering with colour to shame the very stars above. The harmonious sweep of the halo's hues continued far in the distance, holding them silent. But a moment later, they both painted on curious expressions when that distant shimmer shifted from its multitude of hues to a monochrome red. Forte looked back over her shoulder at Talmadge, or started to, but stopped halfway, her eyes going wide and leading his gaze. The red moon began to climb over the eastern shoulder of Firoxpuer.
"We should get to the village, and quickly," Talmadge said.
Only then did he realize that they really were out all alone out here, and looking back he noted the large fires being constructed within Seleth Tulloch.
"Why?"
José asked, obviously sensing his sudden change of mood.
"I like the privacy. I like the view."
She gently stroked his face. "I like the company." Talmadge couldn't help but grin at that. But as tempted as he was, he knew better. "The full moon," he explained. "The villagers huddle when the moon shines red."
"Fables?"
Talmadge shook his head. "Might be, but fanciful tales believed in heart. In all the villages. When the full moon's red, all the tribes, even the Uskar, I am told, huddle beside great fires that steal the red glow."
"Because there are monsters about?"
Hote asked lightly. And it was clear to Talmadge that she wasn't taking any such threat seriously. He wasn't, either, when he considered just the matter of some village fables about some demonic monster. But that was only one concern. "If we stay out through this night, our return will be met with doubting eyes," he explained. "They'll want to know why. They'll want to know how. They'll know we doubted their fables, and so do not value their wisdom." Cote nodded and moved past him, taking his hand and turning him as she moved back toward Seleth Tulloch.
"I've no wish to insult them," she said. "They've already come to like me more than they like Talmadge, and if I'm to take over your trading routes, I need to continue that."
That brought a laugh to Talmadge, and he playfully swatted Hote on the rump as he caught up to her. "They only suffer you because they like me so much," he said.
"You tell yourself whatever you need to hold heart," she was quick to reply.
Talmadge pulled her close.
"You should have taken me to this place years ago," Hote said. "But I understand your want of secrecy."
"Not that," he said, stopping his walk and holding her back. He stammered for some response, but couldn't find one.
"I know," she said, helping him out. "Badger's ghost haunted you, but there's more than that. Be truthful, my love. This place, Lochbjörg and the mountains, the desert below and the stars above, is pure to you, unspoiled. You would keep it that way, and you feared that showing your secret would despoil it."
Again, Talmadge stammered, and in the end he just shrugged and offered, "I don't feel that way now."
"I know," she said, and she kissed him. "And glad I am of it, because I am already in love with this place."
Talmadge answered with a smile, and a silent agreement that he should have brought Cote here years ago. He thought again of Fasachran, where he hoped to be within a week. If their visit there went as he now expected, perhaps they would reconsider their future treks to Lochbjörg and their pre-winter returns to the yearly matinee. Aulin shoved and pushed through the tangled pines, bursting into the open night air. The main encampment was only a few dozen strides away, but it felt like a great yawning gulf to the frightened young woman. She had heard of the rascals, of course, creatures more commonly known as the She. They all had, but she had never seen one. And from what she had heard, she didn't want to see one now. It took her only a few moments to sprint across to the encampment, but by the time she arrived, the entire tribe was rushing about this way and that. She glanced all around, unsure, but settled her gaze on Shona, who stood by the blazing bonfire, along with the witches of the coven.
The warriors rushed up from every angle, all carrying their crystal-tipped spears to thrust them into the flames. It seemed similar to the ritual before the raids, Erlen thought, but abbreviated, and with less somber ceremony, with the warriors retracting the weapons very quickly, never getting their hands near the flames, then running off, some to formations, a few select others with a single witch, their wives, Erlen realized, heading for their private tents. Erlen didn't understand that particular path. Wasn't there an urgency here? Weren't the warriors mustering?
To my side, girl, Erlen heard,
and her attention went back to Shona, who was motioning to her furiously.
Erlen rushed over to join her teacher,
100 questions bubbling about her lips.
Stay,
Shona instructed.
What is happening?
Hush, no time. Stay by my side.
For once, Erlen did as instructed, and even held silent as Shona went back to her task. She grabbed one of the dancing witches and pulled her from the line, directing her to a warrior who had just freed his weapon from the bonfire. The two, witch and warrior, rushed together, then ran off for a tent. For their tent, Erlen realized. For she knew these two and understood them to be married. A movement of the side of that tent caught her attention, and she glanced back to the flap of the other tent, where she'd seen the other couple disappear. Now just the warrior emerged, spear in hand, eyes and expression fierce, ready for battle. Erlen wanted to ask Shona about that, but a deep voice behind her called out to her,
Erlen! Wife!
Erlen jumped at the sound, the hairs on the back of her neck standing up. She swung about to see Breyth coming toward her, spear in hand. She always found that one unsettling, but tonight more than ever. His movements, his gait, his eyes. Oh, his eyes. More feral than human.
Erlen let out a yelp as he stabbed his weapon out right before her.
Bless my spear, my woman, he commanded.
I am not, she stammered. I do not know.
She is not your woman yet,
Shona told the man, drawing a scowl.
We've shared the meal before the venerated, Breyth said. She has been to the trial of the cave. I will have my spear blessed, and will take her to battle with me.
Erlen started to speak, but Shona put her hand up in front of her to silence her.
She would be of little help to you, Shona said. She does not know.
Then show her,
came another voice, startling all three, and they turned as one to see Te Oleg staring at them.
I have earned her, Breyth demanded. I will not go out unshielded.
Erlen started to speak again, but Shona shook her. The young woman looked up at her teacher and gasped at the sight of Shona's face, drawn and ashen, and so clearly afraid.
No!
Te Oleg yelled at them. Out from under the bonfire came Meron, the Uskar Regin, untouched by the flames. Watching her, Erlen wanted to use her own milky crystal and climb under that same fire right then. But of course she could not. She watched Meron go to Te Oleg, and the two walk off toward Meron's tent. Shona grabbed the shaft of Breath's spear and wrapped Erlen's hand over it, then guided the girl to thrust it into the flames. Erlen didn't know what to do, but Shona had not let go. Erlen felt a tingling sensation almost immediately, not unlike the vibrations she had known in the crystal cavern. The fire was magical, she understood, created by the great woman, and through its magic and the guiding energy of Shona, Erlen felt the various powers lock within the crystalline tip of Breath's spear. She felt her own magic drawn out of her, joining with Shona's, and flowing into the weapon, and then she understood more clearly than she had ever imagined. Now, the ritual before the raids made sense to Erlen. Now she realized the advantage the Uskar held over those they battled. Because Shona had just empowered the weapon, Breyth could bring forth the magical effects held in the flex within this spear, including levitation and the healing whetstone, and the lightning of another grey stone.
Come, And quickly,
Shona instructed, retracting the spear from the fires.
Just her, said Braith. She cannot. Not alone. Not at the beginning.
Shona led them toward her tent,